You're listening to Death of the Reader, Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour, and we are here in our final week discussing Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down, an iconic and early Argentinian murder mystery. And Herds...
Flex, what's going on?
I have one word that I think describes my relationship with the end of this book.
Complicated? Is it complicated? Abrupt?
But it's you could say that that's a simile. The word is incongruous.
Incongruous, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel that.
This book, I feel, has a really interesting ending that is very well written, very compelling, but doesn't quite fit the pieces that we're leading into it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure where you're going with that feeling, but I definitely feel like I got to the end of the book and went, oh, that's the end. Interesting. Oh, okay. we take such a leap off a cliff. But yeah.
Yeah, chapter 7 essentially is them looking for the missing man in the puzzle. There is a character who hasn't really appeared yet at all.
Doesn't actually appear
in a way to some of the ways that the crimes happened, but also doesn't really seem to matter and is just a exploratory vessel for Maria Angelica Bosco to flesh out the other details of the crime.
It's absurd. But yes, continue.
And then the final chapter is essentially your breakdown scene, delivered in a way that I feel is largely standard, but also kind of bewildering. Mm. And this is where my love-hate relationship with the end of this book begins.
Sure.
The first time I was reading through this book, I found this tipping point at the start of Where is Emilio Vibia? It's this short passage where Bosco basically describes what Emilio Vibia must have been like. You know, he's a man who didn't have any friends. They were only acquaintances. They were distant.
It sounds like we're setting up the true villain, right? It's like, yes, the true culprit who will reveal as one of the many characters we have seen along the way through this journey. But that is not all the case. In fact, we get a totally dissociated scene about, is it a mother and son, I want to say, who are like living in a farmstead? It's crazy.
That scene basically is Emilio Vibia is set up with this family while he's been hiding from the law, and they send him off with some money, so he's like disappeared from the tale.
Sure.
And
but he doesn't
that,
really appear.
Yes, yeah, it's a little bit weird. They're basically like, here's this character. He was how the crime happened. Also, he's gone now, never to be seen again.
We never see him. Sequel bait, maybe. But
here's where the real tipping point happens, is immediately after this passage about Vibia, which is, you know, still fits in with the style of the rest of the novel, but is a little off kilter and a little bit more emotive than some of the rest of the writing of the book. We then get into a sort of first-person account of Rita's suicide.
Oh, my goodness. It's like poetry, almost. Like, it's on the edge.
And if you've followed this year on Death of the Reader, you'll know that I love this poetic style of writing. I really enjoyed reading this passage, but it feels so out of place in this book.
I think that to try and put a pin on it in my brain hole, which is what I like to do, I think that the like more ephemeral poetic pieces or the strange bits like the farmstead with the family and Rita committing suicide, those are the two bits I think stick out to me the most. They feel like A, they belong in a different book, and B, they feel a bit too mechanical in function for me to like enjoy them properly. I'm like, wait, isn't this all this like talk of, you know, the suicide and Rita like seeing it's like a ladder or something she sees, and she's like, it's my time has come to commit suicide. But it also is like clearly the author is doing this so that she can't be interrogated. Like, it feels a bit
weirdly,
off.
Weirdly, the words that I kept using to describe this to my friends while I was reading through this book is it felt like someone had inserted a rock opera number into the middle of this book. It doesn't read like a rock opera, but my brain was like, there needs to be an epic, like, way too many guitars musical score that underlies this scene and makes it just way more dramatic, because that's the way it feels compared to the rest of the book. And there's this weird point for me where I really love the way that it's presented and the styles that it delivers, but I'm also reminded of, like, you know, a song that introduces something right at the end of it, and you're like, well, why didn't you put that, you know, earlier in the song? It just feels like it shouldn't be here. It feels like you've tacked on the end of another song here.
Yeah, there's a few scenes and a few moments and characters that I feel like are given more weight in the way that they're written in their like final moments than they really deserved. And also some parts of the story that I feel like I was expecting more from, which we kind of drifted away from, like Muck as a character, which like...
Yeah, big shame.
I don't know what happened to Muck. Like,
the guy just said he wants Muck back and then he's gone from the story. And then, but he was like the best part.
I was like, this Muck, like, he, you know, the murderer is giving a dog to the detectives.
Yeah.
And like, surely this is going to be important in some way. Like, the dog's going to sniff out the poison or finger the culprit or like, ah, this is the reason you gave us Muck to begin with. Something, anything. But I, you're right. Do we even hear anything about Muck after he gets taken back by Adinger? Like, I don't think so.
Nope.
No, that's very strange. Yeah, it's bizarre.
I wouldn't be surprised. I couldn't find definitively because trying to Google translate Argentinian resources on the internet was giving me headaches.
Good luck.
But I wouldn't be surprised if this was the result of serialization in a newspaper, because it was still within an era where serialization would have been a thing. It was hard to say for sure. I mean, but it is really weird how these pieces just don't seem to fit together, but still seem to be really cohesive and strong on their own. Yeah.
You really feel like the novel is like going somewhere, and it is, like, not to throw too much shade at this book. It's still a great time, but there's lots of pieces that I'm like, why wasn't this set up properly? Why is this set up but never paid off? I'm not sure what's going in. Who is this Emilio character? Why is there a love decahedron that is revealed in the final pages of the book? We'll get to that.
We'll get to that. And I also do want to say before we continue that the ending of the mystery I did feel is one of the strongest parts of this tail part of the book.
Mm.
It still ties together all of the actual mystery components. It's just that there are still too many loose threads elsewhere.
For sure. But we'll get into that in the mystery section. Whoa.
I think the other thing that was very interesting getting towards the end of the book stylistically was that there was a lot of the metaphor that I enjoyed at the early part of the book that had been abandoned. And this is a very similar point, I suppose. The main one that comes to mind, and the reason I want to bring it up as its own point, is because the flaws of the building was one of my favorite pieces of the introduction of this book, because it's so clearly set up who was more suspicious than anyone else. And obviously, in some ways, the ending being subversive of that is still an interesting use of that idea that, oh, maybe it wasn't actually that each floor of the building was more suspicious than the next, but it doesn't get resolved so much as shelved.
It feels like that's, that like piece of the puzzle isn't used to its fullest potential, which is, you know, it's fine. Like, let's be clear, like, we do get some kind of interesting reveals, and the way that the detectives actually expose the criminal at the end is quite fun. It's one of those like risky play kind of things that I really enjoy.
I mean, the scene where they give a few of the suspects a script to read out to reenact the scene was hilarious.
Like, you young lady, play the deceased. Like, just read out her lines.
Yeah, it's like, hello, it's I am Frieda Eidinger.
The dead
and
person.
And they point out that her like accent's all wrong and she's performing it really flat, and it's really cute. And it still works.
They even have, they point out the fact that like they do part of the crime deconstruction downstairs where the media can see so that they're acting as though, like, the pretense here is that they're just doing this as a stunt when actually it is the real actual trap to catch the murderer, and that's why the murderer is like off guard, because the murderer's like, oh no, the poison lipstick, what if they actually kill someone else with the lipstick,
exactly,
and everything is ruined, and I'll have killed someone else who is like I didn't want to kill, and like there's a lot probably going through that person's mind. Not that we get to really hear any of it, but you can imagine what's going through their minds.
Well, yeah, the other thing that's really good about it is that the way that it's delivered in the story, because of this kind of confusing, bewildering tone towards the end of the book here, you are off guard when it happens as well.
Mm.
So when the book just says, and then the culprit stood up and his plan was ruined because he thought someone else was going to be poisoned, you're like, oh, wait, what? This was a trap? When did that happen?
It's cool. No, I like that a lot. I like that Bosco was not like, you know, and now we will let the reader know exactly what's going on for this, like, catch the criminal thing. I like that it's a genuine sort of gotcha moment. I think that's really fun.
Yeah, definitely. And it also plays nicely, and this is why 7 and 8, I think, pair really well, even if they don't fit the rest of the book.
Sure.
It fits really nicely with when they're talking is it with the Inaras? And they just go down a list of evidence. It's like, did you know this? Yes. Did you know this? No.
Yes. Oh, it's with Don Augustine first.
Beautiful.
Yeah. It's really good. It feels like we're actually getting answers to it. It feels like you can trust these people's answers that they're giving you. Because we're in the second last chapter of the book and it feels really tense.
Yeah.
And we know that like everyone in this building has something to hide. So finally seeing down with them face to face and saying like, we know almost everything about you. We just need you to confirm some things. It feels really satisfying.
Yeah. And even though they are very different scenes, because they set up this like big pressure moment of like asking the questions, tracking down the culprit, to then having the actual moment where a culprit is revealed be so innocuous upon its initial unveiling, I think it works really well to disarm you as a reader.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought the other thing that I did want to raise, although this is largely insignificant, is I was a little sad that the Suarez Loza family never came back.
I mean,
you know, I was kind of hoping, when Emilio, so much of the plot dealt with, you know, who had come over from Europe and who wanted what from the laws of Europe and who got married in Switzerland, that this family who'd gone away to Europe had nothing to do with any of those just regular herrings.
You know what would have been a fun twist is if the story had been, yes, they are away in Europe, but they were actually like in the walls the whole time, orchestrating everything. Like, yes, of course. You know, that small family there that could fit in all those ducks and vents and things, like they're definitely not around, but they're the ones doing all the killing. I would have loved that, but unfortunately they are delegated to off screen. They do not matter, apparently, so that's exciting.
A thing that I did like, though, is that the book really rewarded you, and I don't know if you noticed this, Herds, is the book really rewarded you for noticing which languages everyone spoke.
Oh, for sure.
And I was very happy with that, because it was the kind of thing that was mentioned often enough to where you like knew it was going to be kind of important, but also still felt very natural, what with how multilingual Argentina is historically, I believe.
Sure.
And then when it comes around at the end and they say like, yes, these two people were working together because if one of them was going to be suspected, his countrymen would probably be roped into it because everyone's still suspicious on the end of World War II.
It's true.
I thought that was a very clever detail that rewarded you for paying attention.
Yeah, it's good. I like that we focused on the concrete evidence. We didn't end up relying on star signs and that sort of thing, and birth symbols and things. instead, we're focusing on the real, like, what do they speak? Where do they live? That sort of thing. What do they have access to? It's always good to have a murder mystery that sticks to that.
And it's also really good because it still tells a, like, multicultural story without leaning on any cultural stereotypes. It just says,
for sure,
these two people would have been suspected together because the world was still suspicious.
Well, except for the Nazi, I believe. He's still a bad egg, from what I can tell.
Well, yeah, but that's still kind of like set up as his actions, you know.
It's true.
It's like he was a terrible person, also he just was a Nazi.
He just happened to be a Nazi, just so that we can all put that on the table,
which as far as history goes, fair enough.
Yeah, look, I agree. I mean, that's what this story is about, right? It's about people who came from Germany who just want to live their own lives. They want to be away from all the Hitler stuff, and they get pulled right back in. It's like a mob story, except with, you know, Argentina. It's good stuff.
It is. I suppose, Herds, we can put a pause on that there, and we will return with the mystery section towards the tail end of the show, covering all of the Fair Play and other whodunit shenanigans as we usually do. We are discussing Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down, the final two chapters. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. Stick around.
The Terra Australis Readers and Writers Festival is on this weekend. An online, international crime and mystery literary festival. A criminally good lineup. Anne Cleves, Val McDermott, Gary Disher, Candace Fox, Solari Gentile, Anita Heiss, and more. There's interviews, book clubs, masterclasses, and panels. Hurry, get your tickets for this online event at terraaustralisfestival.com. Terra Australis Festival. Festival sponsors 2SER 107.3.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down, chapters 7 and 8. That is the end of this book. Herds has been in the hot seat.
Yeah.
And
the cold
this
seat.
Is a book, Herds.
Yep.
This is a book, Herds, that I'm tenuous on how many points to give you.
I would be too. I would be tenuous.
Because I think you were pretty far off the mark. I still think you got a couple of good things in there. So you're at least walking away with one point.
The problem, I get one point. Hold on now. I get one point for posing two different theories. I posed Inara and Eidinger, which
yes.
I think it was correct. And I got the makeup thing, which I felt pretty good about it. Mm-hmm. I thought that was good because Muck was going to be involved with like sussing it out, but yeah, it doesn't matter. Ignore Muck. Muck doesn't matter anymore. Very sad to me. Mm-hmm. But I was very off the mark in terms of the political intrigue angle and the love dodecahedron, as I mentioned in the previous part.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea what was going on there. because I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. Normally I'm very on top of these sort of love plots and the tropes of that sort of thing. But in this one, I just was like, yeah, look, he's just like a doctor who cares. But actually, he's at the center of many women who want to or are currently having an affair with him. Apparently, he's just the most attractive man.
Well, this is where the tenuous nature of these points comes in because, you know, if I was giving points to me, I would have given me the point for two solutions and then 1 point for the few details like the murder weapon and stuff that you noticed. But at the same time, I feel like you really failed where your strengths are here, Herds. And it would almost disgrace me to give you points for that. Like, I don't know. Do you want to talk yourself up?
I mean, look, I'm okay with disgracing you. That sounds like a fine thing for you to do. I mean, look. Yeah, look, it is a shame that I missed the love triangle. Goodness, I don't know. Like, I'm not good at talking myself up, you entire nerd. Why would you do this to me?
I just want you to say nice things about yourself. It's good to be positive occasionally.
I'm not good at that. I don't do it very often. I know. I should do it more often. Look, I did enjoy sort of picking apart the who and the how done it. That is something that I was on top of. I don't know how I was supposed to figure out this Emilia Vibea? Is that how you pronounce it? Vibea?
Vibea.
Look, this is how much I care about this character. I don't even, he's not
it's
even
how
racist.
Much this character deserves.
It really is. But yeah, this Emilia Vibea, like, there was no way I was going to get him. I obviously miss the love stuff, but like, I definitely didn't fall for any of the like regular red herrings. That's good. Like, none of these other families up and down the elevator that you were like, oh yeah. Like, they're so suspicious. Everyone in the group is suspicious. And day one, I was like, it's either, like, the old man or the caretaker. And it was definitely not the caretaker. So, you know.
Yeah.
Inara was immediately suspicious to me, which is great. I definitely feel good for picking out Serbo as like, one of the bad guys. I initially thought that he and Eidinger were more, like, in on it with each other than they really were.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel good about picking those two as the bad guys. Like, if I were the Argentinian police department and I said, it's those two, get them, officers. Like, I would have done my job. The bare basics of the job, but I would have done it.
That's true. You know what, Herds? I think you can walk away with your second point today.
Look, I'll take 2 points. I definitely don't deserve 3 points. So
I completely agree. I completely agree that the third point is completely out of the question.
The why was entirely a mess in this story.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, there definitely were, I think, enough clues in here to talk a little bit about why Frida being killed over the money that her husband wouldn't have got if a divorce had happened was properly set up, because they mentioned pretty clearly that, like, he was married in Switzerland. The law was different over there.
Sure.
And, you know, you do have to extrapolate a little bit to understand exactly what...
You know what the problem is? I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is I specialize in unmarried love, whereas this is about married love. And, like, I don't understand
you
that
say,
stuff. That's all I'm saying.
You say as though this lady didn't come the whole way from Switzerland to Argentina to divorce her husband to have an affair with a man who she knew was here, who was having an affair with another woman.
Look, that involves divorces and things. I'm not good at that stuff. Although you are correct.
Sure.
You're right. She had some kind
of
true love.
That's right, of course, because it's an affair and not just blind romance.
It's true.
It's
young love.
Suddenly out of your wheelhouse.
It's too far. It's too close to married love for my liking. Look, I'm like Solaire. I'm like that guy.
Confirmed afraid of marriage.
It's true. I'm like Solaire. I'm like, I'm just going to hang out and do whatever I want. And let's get away from this tangent before this gets weird. But like, look, I'm just saying, keep marriage away from my murder mystery. It just doesn't.
I mean,
Doesn't help.
That was one of the weird things talking of Solaire about this mystery, is he's set up at the beginning as so incredibly and painfully suspicious.
Well, he's too and suspicious. Can we talk about here's that? He's making your point. We need to talk about the lipstick at some point, though. Good grief.
Here's the thing, yes, is the lipstick is incredibly obvious, goes down the side of the elevator shaft, and all is just a big mess.
Yep.
The thing that really surprised me, though, is that by the end of the book, it's like the cast of forgotten Solaire is there as well.
It's great. Well, he's there. I mean, I mentioned this last time. Like, he's there to be like, ooh, maybe people who, like, have nothing to hide will give too many details or too few. He's there to set up that nervous mindset so he can go back to Eidinger's conversations and be like, man, is he telling a lot of details about things and being sure to mention his wife's name a lot? Like, it's almost like he's trying to convince the cops that he cares about her and that he didn't want her murdered horribly. Like, I like that. I like Solaire as a piece, but you're right. He also is one of those characters that just, like, disappears.
It's kind of interesting because I feel like Emilio Vibila is in the place in the story that Solaire should have been at the end.
Yes, I agree. Like, he was being used or something, right?
Yeah, the guy who was there as a linchpin but didn't really have a major effect on anything that gets out of Dodge at the end. Like, that was what Solaire was right from the beginning.
If we had a scene which was Solaire, like, in the farmstead, covered in pig crap, and just like, well, this isn't where I'd like to be, but I gotta get out of here. Like, he gets on a train at the end and goes off to ruin marriages somewhere else.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is because they set up, right, that Vibila was in the apartment at the time that things happened and is thus entirely interchangeable with Solaire, but also set up to be a very distinct character.
Well, there are definitely some superfluous characters here that I think are buff things out. What's this?
If someone after we post these episodes messages us on social media at Flex and Herds and says, you idiots, they were the same character, I will be very happy and very upset at the same time.
That'd be great. I want to see evidence of the Solaire equals Vibia. I want that theory to be real. I want that to be a thing because that would make me very happy. Can I tell you actually, just while we're talking about how,
by all means, because
I'm done talking myself up half-heartedly. I want to talk about one of the problems that I have because as we all know, I have trouble like keeping names straight. That's just the thing that I have. I think of characters by their role in the story. So the reason why I never in 1,000 years would have, and this is a very personal thing, in 1,000 years would have suspected Luke to have been the center of not one but two affairs in the story is because when I think of the Doctor character, I think like an old man with a little white mustache and like balding and stuff. Like that's just my immediate image when I think of like, yes, the Doctor in a murder mystery. So there was no way.
What's wrong with having a young hot Doctor in the story?
There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, I support it. But when it comes to murder mystery, my immediate reaction is like, yes, old man. Like, oh, yes, I'm the old Doctor. Ooh. Like, that's
I know what kind of books I'm picking next year. As many young hot doctors as I can find.
Can we have lots of murder mystery set in hospitals with young hot doctors that are, they're like, yes, I'm so strong with this surgical knife. Stab, stab, stab. That's what I want. I want young, hot, murderous doctors.
Yeah.
Any gender.
I thought the other thing, anyway, you know,
in my area,
despite this, I guess digression.
Look.
On affairs and young hot doctors.
I just need to be
I will clear. Say that the one thing that was weird to me is that whilst I think there was evidence of all of the affairs and who was going around with who in this story, it also felt like you had to, in some ways, agree with the scathing opinions of women that Maria Angelica Bosco had.
I wasn't going to say anything, but yes, I thought that the reason why Solaire, who's like one of the worst characters in the story, who really should have been a criminal, he was like, what is it about women that means they always have to stand by their man and they always need a man to like look after and stuff? I was like, aha, this is being written by like a young, progressive Argentinian lady writer. And so we're going to get a story about how women can kill men, for example, and they're really great at it.
Yeah, they say like, you know, why did Rita kill herself? Oh, she wasn't strong enough to survive on her own.
And it doesn't feel like we've rejected that hypothesis at all, which was definitely surprising to me.
Yeah, I thought that because as you were saying there, that like all of the male characters who put these opinions forward,
they're dirtbags.
You could kind of infer that they were meant to be wrong.
Yeah.
And that was going to be the crux of things. But to figure out the solution, whilst the solution doesn't disagree, you have to kind of make the assumptions that the men do in the story.
You do.
And that's another one of the really incongruous things about this, is that the book totally does, like, stand up for the independence of women,
mm-hmm.
but also requires you to not follow that train of thought to figure it out. And I'm like, how is this meant to work?
Like, it reminds me of a certain Japanese murder mystery, No Names, which was very highly regarded. But when we read it, the solution was like, you know, because a woman had, like, slept with another man, thus she had to die. And that was, like, the solution to the story. And we were horrified. We were like, this is so gross and awful, and I don't like this solution at all. But it was what the author went with, because that, like, culturally for that particular person was what they believed and what they went with, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I have trouble when I read novels internalizing those sorts of logics where I'm like, I don't know that I agree with this, so I'm just going to, like, skip over it. So that's fine.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when we were covering Murder on the Way, that book has some, like, pretty grim racist undertones,
mm-hmm.
Front tones.
Oh yeah,
main notes to it.
That one actually wasn't too bad, but yes, please continue.
But in that case, right, you have, as a modern reader, as Jim Noyes said, you just kind of have to, like, clench and bear it.
You just get over it because there's so much of it, right? Like, it's so obviously, flagrantly racist that you just, you're like, yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But the thing that's nice about some of these stories, right, is that they're secondary. You know, for example, the way that And Then There Were None has been scrubbed but still completely works as a fiction.
For sure, for sure.
The way that Murder on the Way, well, that was a weird sentence. Murder on the Way has, like, these very racist notes, but it has very little to do with the plot.
Yeah.
Whereas this book here, it's, like, central in a way to the mystery, but isn't explicit about it, and it's so confusing, I think, is the overwhelming feeling.
Yeah, I feel that. I felt that if I want to interpret this story in the way that, like, I'm trying to think about, you know, what is the author's lesson? You know, whenever I watch shows, whatever, I'm always thinking, what is the point? What are you trying to teach us with this?
And often the make or break between a good and a great
story. Absolutely. Yeah, like, you come to these stories where I'm like, okay, so what is the point here? What is the lesson? And how does the actual murder mystery support that lesson? And I definitely feel like this was a novel where I couldn't quite congruate those thoughts in my mind. I didn't feel great about it, you know?
Here's my closing thought before we move on to the next book, and let me know if you agree with this.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like this is a book that analytically and in a lot of ways I really love, but at the same time wasn't for me.
Sure.
And I really want to recommend this book so that I can find someone who enjoys it as much as it deserves.
Look, I would love to chat with people who understand the historical context a bit better than we do, and who like have a bit more of an appreciation for this story.
Yeah.
Because it's clearly, like, successful and popular and that sort of thing, which is great. Iconic was the word that you used.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, because we're down to, like, the pointy end right before review season, and, like, I want to put this up the list so people will read it and it can find the audience that it needs. That audience just doesn't happen to be us.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, I think that's a good thought to leave off on that, and we should go on our next book on the trail that we blaze.
The last one before review season, Herds. What is it going to be?
Better be good. All righty. We are going to be reading a little book called Murder in Old Bombay, written by Nev March. This is a novel about, it's set in India, and it's about colonialism, and it's going to be an interesting time. I hope you're ready for a novel that is one part murder mystery, one part historical documentary, one part romance. I'm looking forward to it. It's a long book. You should probably get started on that one, Flex.
I definitely will get started. I think the other interesting thing, Herds, is we've kind of, through Murder on the Way and Death Going Down, set ourselves up for a little stretch on, like, colonial stories.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. And this is written by a writer of color, Nev March. She actually reached out to me and said that, you know, it could be a good book to cover on the show. So we're doing it.
Yeah, fantastic. And of course, if you have any recommendations for books you'd like us to cover on the show, be sure to hit us up at Flex and Herds on social media. We're about to hit review season, as I mentioned, so that gives us a bit of time to research where our world tour takes us next year. We'd love to hear your recommendations of what to feature and who to have join us on the show, like we did with Sean Britton and Jim Noy earlier this year. That is at Flex and Herds, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And my goodness, I'm looking forward to it. What chapters for next week, dear Herds?
Well, I mean, we're going to be doing up to chapter from chapters 1 to chapter 24. on murdering all Bombay.
Herds, thank you so much for joining me here for Death Going Down.
It's been great.
I'm very excited to have finally gotten the chance to read this book, because as with many of the ones we cover on the show, it's part of my ever-increasing and never-shrinking to-read pile.
It's true. It's true. Too many books.
So it's good to chip a little one off.
Yeah.
We will see you next week on the show with Murder in Old Bombay. Woo-hoo! This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour here on 2SER 107.3, and we'll see you then.
See you next time.